美国之音现在开始中文广播。
在以下的一小时里，我们将重播昨天晚上十点的时事经纬节目。首先请听最新的国际新闻。
美国总统奥巴马敦促世界各地领导人和他共同努力削弱和摧毁伊斯兰国。奥巴马星期三在纽约联合国大会上发表讲话说，伊斯兰国用斩首、枪杀儿童、抛尸万人坑、扼杀宗教少数派这些方式恐吓伊拉克和叙利亚的无辜平民。奥巴马呼吁全世界，尤其是穆斯林社区，坚决抵制伊斯兰国和基地组织的意识形态。他说，必须铲除暴力极端主义主毒瘤。奥巴马还谴责俄罗斯干预乌克兰危机，他说俄罗斯正在挑战战后秩序。此外，他还敦促展开更广泛的全球努力，遏制已在西非导致数千人死亡的埃博拉疫情。另一方面，美国总统奥巴马敦促伊斯兰国武装分子在还能够离开战场时赶紧离开。在此几个小时前，美国向在叙利亚的伊斯兰国激进组织发起了第二轮空袭。奥巴马在纽约联合国大会上讲话时指责世界各地爆发的教派冲突为伊斯兰国这类的组织制造了肥沃的招募土壤。伊斯兰国以数月的血腥武装攻势攻占了叙利亚和伊拉克的部分领土。奥巴马说，跟这帮邪恶之徒没有道理可讲，没有谈判可言，这帮凶手能够理解的唯一语言就是武力。因此，美国将与广泛的盟友合作，摧毁这个死亡的网络。联合国秘书长潘基文在早些时候的开幕式上呼吁世界领导人对该地区滋生极端主义的原因展开坦率的讨论。过去一周里，伊斯兰国在叙利亚北部的攻势导致13万多人流离失所。一名法国公民本周早些时候被一个跟伊斯兰国有关联的阿尔及利亚激进组织斩首。星期三出现的视频显示，一个被称为哈里发的士兵的组织成员手举法国人古德尔的头颅。55岁的古德尔星期天与朋友在阿尔及利亚一个山区远足时被绑架。法国总统奥朗德谴责这起谋杀是残酷的懦夫行为。本周早些时候，该组织威胁要杀死古德尔，因为法国参与了针对在叙利亚的伊斯兰国激进组织的空袭行动。法国总统在联合国大会期间誓言要继续打击伊拉克的伊斯兰国激进分子。自今年8月初来，伊斯兰国激进分子已经以相同的方式斩首2名美国人和1名英国人。下面来关注俄罗斯经济。世界银行星期三公布的一份研究报告显示，俄罗斯经济增长缓慢，可能在未来2年内陷于停滞。世行说，俄罗斯今年的经济增长率可能只有 0.5%， 而2015年和2016年的增长将更加缓慢。世行的预测比俄罗斯政府准备的预测更加悲观。世行的专家怀疑说，他们对克里姆林宫就未来投资增长的预测表示怀疑。美国新建房屋的销售8月份猛增 18%。商业部星期三的报告说，如果这个销售速度持续一年，美国50万住房会有新的屋主。这是自2008年以来新屋销售的最快速度，给美国近几个月来销售报告喜忧参半的房市带来复苏的乐观迹象。不过，新屋销售在美国房屋市场只占大约1/10，美国房屋交易以居住过的现房为主。八月份市场较大的现房销售在几个月的持续增长之后下跌。由于美国房市的严重问题是导致最近经济衰退的主要原因，经济学家和投资人都密切关注房市的情况。
各位听众您好，欢迎您收听美国之音，在9月24号北京时间晚上10点，美国东岸时间早上10点，从美国首都华盛顿现场直播的时事经纬节目，我是赵婉成。这期节目的重点包括奥巴马总统在联合国大会上发表讲话，重点将是打击伊斯兰国武装分子，美国对叙利亚境内的目标实施第二波的空袭，美国国务卿克里表示 和平异议人士、维族学者伊利哈木土赫提被判刑，只能加剧紧张的局势。中国一个草根图书馆关门，可能是因为当局害怕公民社会的出现。而台湾再传出政府高官涉嫌向中国大陆泄露机密情报的事件，有关的内容我们会在节目中详细为您报告。下面呢，我们先来看今天的头条新闻。美国总统奥巴马星期三要在联合国大会发表讲话，他现在刚刚抵达了联合国。美国政府高级官员表示，奥巴马在讲话中将强调建立一个国际联盟的必要性，共同打击已经在叙利亚和伊拉克境内控制了大片地区的伊斯兰国激进组织。那么奥巴马总统预计将在美国当地时间星期三晚上的时候呢，主持联合国安理会的会议，预计这个安理会成员国到时候将通过一个涉及外国武装人员参与恐怖组织问题的协议。星期三，美国领导的联盟连续发动第二天针对叙利亚境内的伊斯兰国激进组织目标。五角大楼发言人科比海军少将说，星期三的空袭目标是武装分子用来将物资越界运到伊拉克的一个地方。科比在美国有线电视新闻网 CNN 节目中说，美国空袭的目标还包括伊拉克境内靠近库尔德城市埃尔比勒以及伊拉克首都巴格达的伊斯兰国激进组织成分。华盛顿和五个阿拉伯盟国在星期二首次对叙利亚境内的伊斯兰国组织目标发动了空袭。美国军方发言人说，第一天的定点空袭效果如美方事先希望看到的。叙利亚人权观察组织公布消息说，有120名伊斯兰国和基地组织的武装分子在星期二的空袭中丧生。下面我们再来看一则新闻，那就是中国当局在星期二在新疆乌鲁木齐中级法院以分裂国家罪将维吾尔族学者伊利哈木土赫提判处无期徒刑，引发了国际间的广泛关注和谴责。在美国，白宫方面星期二发表声明，对伊利哈木的定罪和判刑深表关切。声明说，伊利哈木作为公民社会领导人，在减轻中国民族关系紧张问题上发挥了重要的作用。他是以和平方式表达自己的观点，不应该因言获罪。白宫的声明还说，中国政府应当释放伊利哈木和他仍然在押的学生，他们在中国以及国际人权义务下享有的权利跟自由应该得到保障。白宫在声明中还呼吁中国政府对于和平表达异议或者说是旗舰的行为同暴力极端主义要区分开来。美国国务卿克里也针对伊利哈木土赫提被判刑的事件发表声明，他说，像土赫提这样的和平意见人士被判刑只会加剧紧张局势。他还说，和平意见不是罪。克里在声明中说，美国对于伊利哈木土赫提被定罪并且被判终身监禁深感不安，如此重判的刑期看起来是对土赫提教授他以和平方式推动中国维族人权的报复。在声明中，国务卿克里说，多年来伊利哈木土赫提致力于促进维汉两族的互相理解、包容和对话，从而和平推动维汉两族的和谐与团结，他也因此为世人所知。他的拘押使得来自维族的一个重要温和的声音消失了。克里星期二还表示，他多次曾经向中国当局提出土赫提教授的案子，包括七月份在美中战略与经济对话期间也提出过。上个星期鲍卡斯大使在访问新疆的时候也特别提出要求释放土赫提。克里说，在此美国再次呼吁中国当局释放土赫提教授以及他那些在押的学生们。星期二在中国外交部的例行记者会上，中国外交部发言人华春莹在被问到土赫提一案的时候，他表示，中国是依法审理，中国反对外国干涉中国的司法独立和主权。
美国之音时事经纬，欢迎收听。
各位听众，中国的一个民间教育公益机构叫丽人乡村图书馆，因为这个图书馆不堪当局被视为敏感组织，还有长期呢以多种手段来打压，决定呢停止运营。所以呢，有关于这条消息，我们待会在节目中会为您做详细的报道。 那么在台湾方面呢，台湾现在再传出了政府高官涉嫌向中国大陆泄露机密情报的事件。台湾驻美国的最高军事官员据信呢被发现跟一名在美国搜集情报的中国女间谍往来亲密，已经被调职。那么台湾社会现在呢，其实就在涉及向中国大陆泄密的谍情可以说是越演越烈。不久前社会高度关注前行政院陆委会副主委张显耀泄密案的同时呢，现在又传出了一名军方高级官员可能向中共间谍涉密的报道。所以呢，有关这个消息呢，我们下面还会给您做详细的报道。那么有关于中国这个草根图书馆呢，丽人乡村图书馆，它因为不堪当局的这个可以说是不断升级的打压，决定停止运营。而在这同时呢，在中国一些高校开展活动的独立民间组织成都爱思青年公益发展中心也遭到了当局的调查，原因说是涉嫌勾结境外反华势力。有分析认为，草根性的民间公益团体在中国的发展屡屡受到政府的打压还有遏制，这反映出当局担心民间组织的发展会促进公民社会成长壮大的恐惧心理。有关的详情下面就请您收听美国之音记者叶斌在华盛顿所做的报道。
已经成立七年，在中国十多个省市的农村地区陆续开设了22家分支机构的丽人乡村图书馆，9月18号被迫宣布关闭，引起了多方关注。据说中宣部禁止媒体公开报道相关事件，但民间和网上仍有不少人对这家非盈利的民间教育机构所说的遭受不明打压发表评论。一位网友称，中国成了一个容不下乡村图书馆的国家。另一网友认为，当局不能容忍 NGO 壮大，特别是在当局的一套说教没人相信的时候。也有网友留言指出，丽人乡村图书馆停止运营是由于校方取消合作，而不是政府强行关闭。还有人认为，丽人乡村图书馆邀请一些社会名人开讲座，涉及了公民权利等被当局认为敏感的议题。丽人乡村图书馆理事会在讨论决定停止运营后发表的公开信中指出，这家立足农村、提倡教育丽人和注重品质的图书馆所承受的长期而巨大的压力是不公义的，当局对丽人的打压是违背国法、天理良心的，是对转型社会的巨大伤害。这封公开信列举了2011年该机构得到社会各界爱心人士和志愿者的支持，正在不断壮大发展之际开始遭受压力的情况。公开信说，2012年丽人图书馆所受压力全面升级，先后有6个图书馆被迫关闭，包括河北的2个图书馆和湖北的4个图书馆，这其中就有已经从合作学校搬出来的黄坎图书馆。有关部门频繁给房东施压，在图书馆对面安装摄像头，给当地基层政府施压，最后甚至使用黑社会上门威胁的方法迫使此馆关闭。丽人乡村图书馆的负责人贺飞辉对美国之音表示，来自政府多个部门的不明压力导致该机构在各地的分馆无法继续运营，通常是各地学校等合作单位以一些借口要求停止合作。
有，比如说我们跟学校合作的一些图书馆，学校一般会借口就说他们不需要我们在这里运营了，然后他们有专门的老师来管理，这是一种借口。另外一种借口就是比较直接一点，就会说是上面的压力。然后我们问上面是指哪个上面，然后他就不说了。然后我们问是不是教育局，然后他说，他就说我不会告诉你们的。这个大概是学校里面的管的情况，然后是社区里面的管呢，他就，会是一般是文化局过来，还有民政局也会过来，他会说我们没有在当地注册，我们不能够运营社区图书馆。
这位在四川成都的社会公益志愿者表示，从北大硕士李英强创办丽人乡村图书馆之初至今，该机构的财务完全公开透明，经费大部分来自民间的小额捐款，海外捐助的数额和所占比例都很小，而且捐助方不得附加任何条件或政治目的。
基 境外势力啊、宗教啊、维权啊都没有，因为这个机构它是一个很单纯的，就是在乡村做阅读，以阅读来做启蒙的一个教育项目，所以它跟这些都没有关系。
李英强创办这个机构以后，成为基督徒。他强调丽人图书馆是非宗教性的，也是非政治性的。这位民营机构创办人2010年在新年献词中表示，该机构不关注农民组织，不关注基层选举，不揭露腐败，不参与维权，只是在青少年中普及一些公民常识。贺飞辉认为，政府可能对公民社会的成长所带来的影响有所顾忌。
因为我们这个机构它有很多文化人他参与进来，也有很多因为我们也动员了很多社会上的就是白领，他们来城市里面的人来给我们做小额的捐款，还有很多大学生志愿者到乡村来做志愿者，所以它形成了一个公民参与这种社会建设的一种运作的模式，我觉得可能是因为这个吧，因为这样的话，可能政府会觉得这个机构有很强的，就是组织社会进行这种社会建设的能力，可能会形成一种，公民的这种自由结社啊，因为在形成这样一个局面。
就在这个面向农村学生的草根公益组织面临巨大压力的同时，一家活跃在一些高校校园的公益团体艾斯青年公益发展中心也遭遇了前所未有的压力。有关部门出台文件，将其定为涉嫌勾结境外反华势力的非法组织，与该团体有关的社团负责人被调查约谈，给师生们造成了恐慌和压力。9月12号，这个成立于2011年并于2013年在成都市民政局注册的民办非企业发表公开信，指出该机构受到污蔑和诽谤，要求高校的相关部门不要再向学生扩大恐慌或施压，并要求有关部门尽快向教育系统说明情况，还其清白，还公众一个真相，做到依法办事，公正公开。艾斯青年中心表示，该机构理事长已经跟有关部门负责人沟通，双方之间的确。
各位听众，美国总统奥巴马现在正在联合国大会发表讲话，这个讲话非常的重要，我们待会儿立刻为您做实况转播，敬请期待。
His Excellency Barack Obama, President of the United States of America, and to invite him to address the Assembly.
Mr. President, Mr. Secretary General, fellow delegates, ladies and gentlemen, we come together at a crossroad.
各位听众，现在您听到的就是美国总统奥巴马在联合国发表的讲话实况。
And integration between fear and hope. Around the globe, there are signposts of progress.The shadow of world war that existed at the founding of this institution has been lifted, and the prospect of war between major powers reduced. The ranks of member states has more than tripled, and more people live under governments they elected. Hundreds of millions of human beings have been freed from the prison of poverty, with the proportion of those living in extreme poverty.Cut in half. And the world economy continues to strengthen after the worst financial crisis of our lives. Today, whether you live in downtown Manhattan or in my grandmother's village more than 200 miles from Nairobi, you can hold in your hand more information than the world's greatest libraries. Together,We've learned how to cure disease and harness the power of the wind and the sun. The very existence of this institution is a unique achievement. The people of the world committing to resolve their differences peacefully and to solve their problems together. I often tell young people in the United States that despite the headlines, this is the best time in human history to be born. For you are more likely than ever before to be literate, to be healthy, to be free to pursue your dreams. And yet there is a pervasive unease in our world. A sense that the very forces that have brought us together have created new dangers and made it difficult for any single nation to insulate itself from global forces. As we gather here, an outbreak of Ebola overwhelms public health systems in West Africa and threatens to move rapidly across borders. Russian aggression in Europe recalls the days when large nations trampled small ones in pursuit of territorial ambition. The brutality of terrorists in Syria and Iraq forces us to look into the heart of darkness. Each of these problems demands urgent attention, but they also are symptoms of a broader problem. The failure of our international system to keep pace with an interconnected world. We collectively have not invested adequately in the public health capacity of developing countries. Too often we have failed to enforce international norms when it's inconvenient to do so. And we have not confronted forcefully enough the intolerance, sectarianism, and hopelessness that feeds violent extremism in too many parts of the globe. Fellow delegates, we come together as United Nations with a choice to make. We can renew the international system that has enabled so much progress, or we can allow ourselves to be pulled back by an undertow of instability. We can reaffirm our collective responsibility to confront global problems, or be swamped by more and more outbreaks of instability. And for America, the choice is clear. We choose hope over fear. We see the future not as something out of our control, but as something we can shape for the better through concerted and collective effort. We reject fatalism or cynicism when it comes to human affairs. We choose to work for the world as it should be, as our children deserve it to be. There's much that must be done to meet the test of this moment. But today I'd like to focus on two defining questions at the root of so many of our challenges. Whether the nations here today will be able to renew the purpose of the UN's founding, and whether we will come together to reject the cancer of violent extremism. First, all of us, big nations and small, must meet our responsibility to observe and enforce international norms. We are here because others realize that we gain more from cooperation than conquest. 100 years ago, a world war claimed the lives of many millions, proving that with the terrible power of modern weaponry, the cause of empire ultimately leads to the graveyard. It would take another world war to roll back the forces of fascism, the notions of racial supremacy, and form this United Nations to ensure that no nation can subjugate its neighbors and claim their territory. Recently, Russia's actions in Ukraine challenge this post-war order. Here are the facts. After the people of Ukraine mobilized popular protests and calls for reform, their corrupt president fled. Against the will of the government in Kiev, Crimea was annexed. Russia poured arms into eastern Ukraine, fueling violent separatists and a conflict that has killed thousands. When a civilian airliner was shot down from areas that these proxies controlled. They refused to allow access to the crash for days. When Ukraine started to reassert control over its territory, Russia gave up the pretense of merely supporting the separatists and moved troops across the border. This is a vision of the world in which might makes right. A world in which one nation's borders can be redrawn by another, and civilized people are not allowed to recover the remains of their loved ones because of the truth that might be revealed. America stands for something different. We believe that right makes might, that bigger nations should not be able to bully smaller ones, and that people should be able to choose their own future. And these are simple truths, but they must be defended. America and our allies will support the people of Ukraine as they develop their democracy and economy. We will reinforce our NATO allies and uphold our commitment to collective self-defense. We will impose a cost on Russia for aggression, and we will counter falsehoods with the truth. And we call upon others to join us on the right side of history. For while small gains can be won at the barrel of a gun, they will ultimately be turned back if enough voices support the freedom of nations and peoples to make their own decisions. Moreover, a different path is available, the path of diplomacy and peace and the ideals this institution is designed to uphold. The recent ceasefire agreement in Ukraine offers an opening to achieve those objectives. If Russia takes that path, a path that for stretches of the post-Cold War period resulted in prosperity for the Russian people, then we will lift our sanctions and welcome Russia's role in addressing common challenges. After all, that's what the United States and Russia have been able to do in past years, from reducing our nuclear stockpiles to meeting our obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to cooperating to remove and destroy Syria's declared chemical weapons. And that's the kind of cooperation we are prepared to pursue again if Russia changes course. This speaks to a central question of our global age, whether we will solve our problems together in a spirit of mutual interest and mutual respect, or whether we descend into the destructive rivalries of the past. When nations find common ground, not simply based on power, but on principle, then we can make enormous progress. And I stand before you today committed to investing American strength to working with all nations to address the problems we face in the 21st century. As we speak, America is deploying our doctors and scientists, supported by our military, to help contain the outbreak of Ebola and pursue new treatments. But we need a broader effort to stop a disease that could kill hundreds of thousands, inflict horrific suffering, destabilize economies, and move rapidly across borders. It's easy to see this as a distant problem until it is not. And that is why we will continue to mobilize other countries to join us in making concrete commitments, significant commitments to fight this outbreak and enhance our system of global health security for the long term. America is pursuing a diplomatic resolution to the Iranian nuclear issue as part of our commitment to stop the spread of nuclear weapons and pursue the peace and security of a world without them. And this can only take place if Iran seizes this historic opportunity. My message to Iran's leaders and people has been simple and consistent. Do not let this opportunity pass. We can reach a solution that meets your energy needs while assuring the world that your program is peaceful. America is and will continue to be a Pacific power, promoting peace, stability, and the free flow of commerce among nations. But we will insist that all nations abide by the rules of the road and resolve their territorial disputes peacefully, consistent with international law. That's how the Asia-Pacific has grown. And that's the only way to protect this progress going forward. America is committed to a development agenda that eradicates extreme poverty by 2030. We will do our part to help people feed themselves, power their economies, and care for their sick. And if the world acts together, we can make sure that all of our children enjoy lives of opportunity and dignity. America is pursuing ambitious reductions in our carbon emissions, and we've increased our investments in clean energy. We will do our part and help developing nations do theirs. But the science tells us we can only succeed in combating climate change if we are joined in this effort by every other nation, by every major power. That's how we can protect this planet for our children and our grandchildren. In other words, on issue after issue, we cannot rely on a rule book written for a different century. If we lift our eyes beyond our borders, if we think globally, and if we act cooperatively, we can shape the course of this century as our predecessors shaped the post-World War II age. But as we look to the future, one issue risks a cycle of conflict that could derail so much progress, and that is the cancer of violent extremism that has ravaged so many parts of the Muslim world. Of course, terrorism is not new. Speaking before this assembly, President Kennedy put it well. Terror is not a new weapon, he said. Throughout history, it has been used by those who could not prevail, either by persuasion or example. In the 20th century, terror was used by all manner of groups who failed to come to power through public support. But in this century, we have faced a more lethal and ideological brand of terrorists who have perverted one of the world's great religions. With access to technology that allows small groups to do great harm, they have embraced a nightmarish vision that would divide the world into adherents and infidels, killing as many innocent civilians as possible, employing the most brutal methods to intimidate people within their communities. I have made it clear that America will not base our entire foreign policy on reacting to terrorism. Instead, we've waged a focused campaign against Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, taking out their leaders, denying them the safe havens they rely on. At the same time, we have reaffirmed again and again that the United States is not and never will be at war with Islam. Islam teaches peace. Muslims the world over aspire to live with dignity and a sense of justice. And when it comes to America and Islam, there is no us and them, there is only us, because millions of Muslim Americans are part of the fabric of our country. So we reject any suggestion of a clash of civilizations. Belief in permanent religious war is the misguided refuge of extremists who cannot build or create anything, and therefore peddle only fanaticism and hate. And it is no exaggeration to say that humanity's future depends on us uniting against those who would divide us along the fault lines of tribe or sect, race or religion. But this is not simply a matter of words. Collectively, we must take concrete steps to address the danger posed by religiously motivated fanatics and the trends that fuel their recruitment. Moreover, this campaign against extremism goes beyond a narrow security challenge. For while we've degraded methodically core al-Qaeda and supported a transition to a sovereign Afghan government, extremist ideology has shifted to other places, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, where a quarter of young people have no job, where food and water could grow scarce, where corruption is rampant, and sectarian conflicts have become increasingly hard to contain. As an international community, we must meet this challenge with a focus on four areas. First, the terrorist group known as ISIL must be degraded and ultimately destroyed. This group has terrorized all who they come across in Iraq and Syria. Mothers, sisters, daughters have been subjected to rape as a weapon of war. Innocent children have been gunned down. Bodies have been dumped in mass graves. Religious minorities have been starved to death. In the most horrific crimes imaginable, innocent human beings have been beheaded with videos of the atrocity distributed to shock the conscience of the world. No God condones this terror. No grievance justifies these actions. There can be no reasoning, no negotiation with this brand of evil. The only language understood by killers like this is the language of force. So the United States of America will work with a broad coalition to dismantle this network of death. In this effort, we do not act alone, nor do we intend to send U.S. troops to occupy foreign lands. Instead, we will support Iraqis and Syrians fighting to reclaim their communities. We will use our military might in a campaign of airstrikes to roll back ISIL. We will train and equip forces fighting against these terrorists on the ground. We will work to cut off their financing and to stop the flow of fighters into and out of the region. And already over 40 nations have offered to join this coalition. Today I ask the world to join in this effort. Those who have joined ISIL should leave the battlefield while they can. Those who continue to fight for a hateful cause will find they are increasingly alone. For we will not succumb to threats, and we will demonstrate that the future belongs to those who build, not those who destroy. So that's an immediate challenge, a first challenge that we must meet. The second, it is time for the world, especially Muslim communities, to explicitly, forcefully, and consistently reject the ideology of organizations like al-Qaeda and ISIL. It is one of the tasks of all great religions to accommodate devout faith with a modern, multicultural world. No children are born hating, and no children anywhere should be educated to hate other people. There should be no more tolerance of so-called clerics who call upon people to harm innocents because they're Jewish, or because they're Christian, or because they're Muslim. It is time for a new compact among civilized peoples of this world to eradicate war at its most fundamental source, and that is the corruption of young minds by violent ideology. That means cutting off the funding that fuels this hate. It's time to end the hypocrisy of those who accumulate wealth through the global economy and then siphon funds to those who teach children to tear it down. That means contesting the space that terrorists occupy, including the internet and social media. Their propaganda has coerced young people to travel abroad to fight their wars and turn students, young people full of potential, into suicide bombers. We must offer an alternative vision. It means bringing people of different faiths together. All religions have been attacked by extremists from within at some point, and all people of faith have a responsibility to lift up the value at the heart of all great religions. Do unto thy neighbor as you would have done unto yourself. The ideology of ISIL or Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram will wilt and die if it is consistently exposed and confronted and refuted in the light of day. Look at the new forum for promoting peace in Muslim societies. Sheikh Bin Bayad described its purpose. We must declare war on war so the outcome will be peace upon peace. Look at the young British Muslims who responded to terrorist propaganda by starting the Not In My Name campaign, declaring ISIS is hiding behind a false Islam. Look at the Christian and Muslim leaders who came together in the Central African Republic to reject violence. Listen to the Imam who said, "Politics try to divide the religious in our country, but religion shouldn't be a cause of hate, war, or strife." Later today, the Security Council will adopt a resolution that underscores the responsibility of states to counter violent extremism. But resolutions must be followed by tangible commitments, so we're accountable when we fall short. Next year, we should all be prepared to announce the concrete steps that we have taken to counter extremist ideologies in our own countries. By getting intolerance out of schools, stopping radicalization before it spreads, and promoting institutions and programs that build new bridges of understanding. Third, we must address the cycle of conflict, especially sectarian conflict, that creates the conditions that terrorists prey upon. There's nothing new about wars within religions. Christianity endured centuries of vicious sectarian conflict. Today, it is violence within Muslim communities that has become the source of so much human misery. It is time to acknowledge the destruction wrought by proxy wars and terror campaigns between Sunni and Shia across the Middle East. And it is time that political, civic, and religious leaders reject sectarian strife. For let's be clear. This is a fight that no one is winning. A brutal civil war in Syria has already killed nearly 200,000 people, displaced millions. Iraq has come perilously close to plunging back into the abyss. The conflict has created a fertile recruiting ground for terrorists who inevitably export this violence. The good news is we also see signs that this tide could be reversed. We have a new inclusive government in Baghdad, a new Iraqi prime minister welcomed by his neighbors, Lebanese factions rejecting those who try to provoke war. And these steps must be followed by a broader truce. Nowhere is this more necessary than Syria. Together with our partners, America is training and equipping the Syrian opposition to be a counterweight to the terrorists of ISIL and the brutality of the Assad regime. But the only lasting solution to Syria's civil war is political. An inclusive political transition that responds to the legitimate aspirations of all Syrian citizens, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of creed. Now, cynics may argue that such an outcome can never come to pass. But there is no other way for this madness to end, whether 1 year from now or 10. And it points to the fact that it's time for a broader negotiation in the region in which major powers address their differences directly, honestly, and peacefully across the table from one another, rather than through gun-wielding proxies. I can promise you, America will remain engaged in the region, and we are prepared to engage in that effort. My fourth and final point is a simple one. The countries of the Arab and Muslim world must focus on the extraordinary potential of their people, especially the youth. And here I'd like to speak directly to young people across the Muslim world. You come from a great tradition that stands for education, not ignorance, innovation, not destruction, the dignity of life, not murder. Those who call you away from this path are betraying this tradition, not defending it. You have demonstrated that when young people have the tools to succeed, good schools, education in math and science, an economy that nurtures creativity and entrepreneurship, then societies will flourish. So America will partner with those that promote that vision. Where women are full participants in a country's politics or economy, societies are more likely to succeed. And that's why we support the participation of women in parliaments and peace processes, schools, and the economy. If young people live in places where the only option is between the dictates of a state or the lure of an extremist underground, then no counterterrorism strategy can succeed. But where a genuine civil society is allowed to flourish, where people can express their views and organize peacefully for a better life, then you dramatically expand the alternatives to terror. And such positive change need not come at the expense of tradition and faith. We see this in Iraq, where a young man started a library for his peers. "We link Iraq's heritage to their hearts," he said, "and give them a reason to stay." We see it in Tunisia, where secular and Islamist parties worked together through a political process to produce a new constitution. We see it in Senegal, where civil society thrives alongside a strong democratic government. We see it in Malaysia, where vibrant entrepreneurship is propelling a former colony into the ranks of advanced economies. And we see it in Indonesia, where what began as a violent transition has evolved into a genuine democracy. Now, ultimately, the task of rejecting sectarianism and rejecting extremism is a generational task, and a task for the people of the Middle East themselves. No external power can bring about a transformation of hearts and minds. But America will be a respectful and constructive partner. We will neither tolerate terrorist safe havens nor act as an occupying power. We will take action against threats to our security and our allies while building an architecture of counterterrorism cooperation. We will increase efforts to lift up those who counter extremist ideologies and who seek to resolve sectarian conflict. And we will expand our programs to support entrepreneurship and civil society, education and youth, because ultimately these investments are the best antidote to violence. We recognize as well that leadership will be necessary to address the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis. As bleak as the landscape appears, America will not give up on the pursuit of peace. Understand, the situation in Iraq and Syria and Libya should cure anybody of the illusion that the Arab-Israeli conflict is the main source of problems in the region. For far too long, that's been used as an excuse to distract people from problems at home. The violence engulfing the region today has made too many Israelis ready to abandon the hard work of peace. And that's something worthy of reflection within Israel. Because let's be clear, the status quo in the West Bank and Gaza is not sustainable. We cannot afford to turn away from this effort. Not when rockets are fired at innocent Israelis or the lives of so many Palestinian children are taken from us in Gaza. And so long as I am president, we will stand up for the principle that Israelis, Palestinians, the region, and the world will be more just and more safe with two states living side by side in peace and security. So this is what America is prepared to do. Taking action against immediate threats while pursuing a world in which the need for such action is diminished. The United States will never shy away from defending our interests, but we will also not shy away from the promise of this institution and its Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The notion that peace is not merely the absence of war, but the presence of a better life. I realize that America's critics will be quick to point out that at times we too have failed to live up to our ideals, that America has plenty of problems within its own borders. This is true. In a summer marked by instability in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, I know the world also took notice of the small American city of Ferguson, Missouri, where a young man was killed and a community was divided. So yes, we have our own racial and ethnic tensions. And like every country, we continually wrestle with how to reconcile the vast changes wrought by globalization and greater diversity with the traditions that we hold dear. But we welcome the scrutiny of the world. Because what you see in America is a country that has steadily worked to address our problems, to make our union more perfect, to bridge the divides that existed at the founding of this nation. America is not the same as it was 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, or even a decade ago, because we fight for our ideals, and we are willing to criticize ourselves when we fall short. Because we hold our leaders accountable and insist on a free press and independent judiciary. Because we address our differences in the open space of democracy with respect for the rule of law, with a place for people of every race and every religion, and with an unyielding belief in the ability of individual men and women to change their communities and their circumstances and their countries for the better. After nearly 6 years as president, I believe that this promise can help light the world. Because I have seen a longing for positive change, for peace and for freedom and for opportunity and for the end to bigotry in the eyes of young people who I've met around the globe. They remind me that no matter who you are, or where you come from, or what you look like, or what God you pray to, or who you love, there's something fundamental that we all share. Eleanor Roosevelt, a champion of the UN and America's role in it, once asked, Where, after all, do universal human rights begin? In small places, she said, close to home. So close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world, yet they are the world of the individual person. The neighborhood he lives in, the school or college he attends, the factory, farm, or office where he works. Around the world, young people are moving forward, hungry for a better world. Around the world, in small places, they are overcoming hatred and bigotry and sectarianism. And they're learning to respect each other despite differences. The people of the world now look to us here to be as decent and as dignified and as courageous as they are trying to be in their daily lives. And at this crossroads, I can promise you that the United States of America will not be distracted or deterred from what must be done. We are heirs to a proud legacy of freedom, and we're prepared to do what is necessary to secure that legacy for generations to come. I ask that you join us in this common mission for today's children and tomorrow's. Thank you very much.
各位听众，刚才为您所播出的就是美国总统奥巴马在联合国发表讲话的实况录音。在这场讲话里，他非常激情的也深入的谈到了很多的问题，包括世界应该联合起来对付埃博拉的问题。同时呢，他也谈到了乌克兰跟俄罗斯的问题，同时也提到了美国应该呢会尽努力的来解决这个核武器扩散的问题，而相信也可以达到的协议。同时他花了很多的时间向世界的年轻人呼吁，因为年轻人他们正在向前走，他们要接受更好的社会，而生命的尊严呢并不是谋杀。那么美国呢对于这个现在发生的战争呢，他说没有人是赢家，因为已经死伤无数。同时美国绝对不会放弃追求和平，会致力于跟世界各国一起来合作解决目前所发生的问题。好，我们刚刚所听到的就是美国总统奥巴马在联合大会所发表的看法，有关的详细内容我们会在美国之音的各项广播里为您做详细的介绍。
欢迎收听美国之音的中文广播，
以下为您播报最新的国际要闻。美国总统奥巴马敦促世界各地领导人和他共同努力削弱和摧毁伊斯兰国。奥巴马星期三在纽约联合国大会上发表讲话说，伊斯兰国用斩首、枪杀儿童、抛尸万人坑、扼杀宗教少数派这些方式恐吓伊拉克和叙利亚的无辜平民。奥巴马呼吁全世界，尤其是穆斯林社区，坚决抵制伊斯兰国和基地组织的意识形态。他说，必须铲除暴力极端主义毒瘤。奥巴马还谴责俄罗斯干预乌克兰危机。他说，俄罗斯正在挑战战后秩序。此外，他还敦促展开更广泛的全球努力，遏制已在西非导致数千人死亡的埃博拉疫情。奥巴马总统，美国总统奥巴马敦促伊斯兰国武装分子在还能够离开战场时赶紧离开。在此几个小时前，美国向叙利亚的伊斯兰国激进组织发起了第二轮空袭。奥巴马在纽约联合国大会上讲话时，指责世界各地爆发的教派冲突为伊斯兰国这类的组织制造了肥沃的招募土壤。伊斯兰国以数月的血腥武装攻势占领了叙利亚和伊拉克的部分领土。奥巴马说，跟这帮邪恶之徒没有道理可讲，没有谈判可言，这帮凶手能够理解的唯一语言就是武力，因此美国将与广泛的盟国合作摧毁这个死亡的网络。联合国秘书长潘基文在早些时候的开幕式上呼吁世界领导人对该地区滋生极端主义的原因展开坦率的讨论。好，以上就是这一时段的国际要闻。
以上是这一小时的国际新闻。您如果需要获取更多的信息，请访问美国之音网站 www.voachinese.com。 美国之音现在就结束这一个小时的新闻节目，下次播音在北京时间上午8点开始，欢迎到时收听。